you're always learning. You're always, you know, if you're not learning from your mistakes, you're not making enough mistakes. You know, that's what I believe really makes you successful is by having messing up more and more. Let your cameras tell you what they need to tell you year after year. I keep logs of everything and say, okay, this deer disappears on these dates. I've got a deer this year that I'm trying to tell myself, don't go in there again because these are the dates. If I look back on all my cameras for the last 5 years for the deer that I'm trying to hunt this year, it's telling me that if he doesn't get shot within the first 5 days of the season, that he will be back in that area. Learn your calls first, but then know how to use them and when to use them, because I went out and I figured them out. I used it, but I used it completely wrong. It worked, and it worked just like it should have, but it ended up messing me up for the rest of the year because I didn't know how effective a snort wheeze was on a mature deer. And I also didn't understand at the time. I understood, but I didn't really comprehend it, that they're going to go to the downwind side of me. You know, and trail cameras tell you a lot, but you really have to study topo maps and learn wind, learn how it travels through hills. You know, thermals, when you get out west where you're at elk hunting and stuff, I mean, thermals are a big factor. Here in southwest Wisconsin, they're a big factor. That's one big thing, you know, that you have to learn. So there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle. You know, so sometimes we try to make things happen when we shouldn't try to make things happen. You know, because we're educating and messing it up more than anything else.
Welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. A couple things before we jump into this episode. Please, you heard me say a million times, go give us a review on iTunes. Helps me keep this podcast free and helps with the ratings. Also, go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. If you use our promo code John Stallone, all one word, you save 20% off on anything. And it's not just shooting bags. They do glassing pads. They're working on some other really cool stuff coming up here for the hunter, bow hunters also. So go check them out, phoenixshootingbags.com. And if you're looking for a really good hunt, I have some really good opportunities for you. Hit us up on daysinthewild.com. Or check out my blog, johnstallone.me, and send us an email. If you're looking to do a coos deer hunt, javelina, mule deer in South Dakota, we got some opportunities in California as well. So give me a call if you're looking to do something different this year and like to get on a special hunt, Days in the Wild Outfitters, and we'll take care of you. Without further ado, let's jump into this episode. Hi, welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about early season whitetails. We're about to roll into that here pretty soon. So I got my buddy Art Helen on the phone. What's going on, Art?
Good. How are you doing, John?
Yeah, it's been a crazy day, crazy week, to be honest with you, but I'm healthy and my family's healthy and everybody's doing well. So I'm not going to complain.
Yeah, I can't either. I just actually flew in from Alaska late yesterday. So now getting ready to get after these whitetails here in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, I saw your couple of your posts on Instagram and stuff. It looked like you guys were having a good time.
Yeah, we're having a good time. I went up and played with some brown bears and grizzly bears, and you know, so had a lot of fun doing that. And then you know, like I said, kind of now already shifted gears and trying to really concentrate on my whitetails.
Nice. You guys didn't do any hunting, yeah. Right? It was just a photo deal. You guys will go up there, take.
Yeah, it was just a photo deal. We went up. I actually went up to do some brown bear and grizzly bear photos for some work for a couple companies I work with, and then did some moose photos. And then after that, it was just kind of on our own, what I could get for photos after that, but kind of a actual vacation. Cause as you know, and I know, when you're in this business, when people believe that you and I are out vacationing, we're usually trying to work.
Right.
So
yep, that's the one drawback to turning doing what you love into a job. you know.
That is the truth. You know, once you turn, they always say, you know, once you turn what you love into a job, then it's a job.
Yep.
And, yeah, it is. But I can think of worse jobs to have, I can tell you that.
That's for sure. So. That's for sure. So I kind of like to start this off with you sharing a story with us, maybe about one of your early season bucks that, you know, gave you a fit or, you know, gave you a real hard time, and then you figured out some stuff and made a play on them, and it ended up working in your favor. Or maybe it didn't work in your favor, but you learned stuff from it. Either way, we'll start off with that, and then maybe we'll kind of hit some tactic questions and kind of go from there.
Okay. Yeah, it's, you know, you're always learning. You're always, you know, if you're not learning from your mistakes, you're not making enough mistakes. You know, that's what I believe really makes you successful is by having, messing up more and more. And, I have, definitely messed up quite a bit. And, you know, a couple years ago, I was chasing a deer, that I called Forks, and I thought I had that deer pinpointed early season. And, I was going to make my move on him and do what I had to do. And just a little, oh, I don't know, about a week before season started, I would say he changed his pattern just slightly, you know, and I could tell off of cameras, running cell cameras and stuff, what he was doing. He was actually on an early season scrape, mock scrape that I had made. So he'd been hitting that. And if he wasn't traveling that, he had one other route on the farm that he was traveling. Mm-hmm. And about a week before season, he just up and disappeared. And I should have known better from years prior. And I just didn't listen to myself. Even when you know better, and you, when I do seminars and stuff, I tell people all the time, you know, this is what not to do. And what did I do? I did it anyway, you know, and I went in and I panicked, mm-hmm. and tried to figure out where that deer was. Now, what's he doing? Where'd he go? Because this is where he's been for the last 3 years. This is what he's doing. So I panicked and I went in and started putting pressure, you know, 3 to 4 days prior to opening of season, and tried to change a tree stand and tried to, you know, figure things out when I should have just basically stayed out of there, let my cameras work for me, let things do what they should do, you know. And he was doing what deer do, you know. He was getting rid of his velvet. He was, hormones were changing, checking some things. And I just, like I said, I panicked and put a lot of pressure on that deer. And I had read years ago that on a mature buck, just going into their area, like the first day of hunting, if you don't do it right, that's similar to putting 3 to 5 days of pressure on that deer. So if you go in there 2-3 days in a row, you know, you just shut that mature deer down for at least a week or more. And that's what I did. And because I panicked, I just went in and said, you know, I got to change this. I have to do this. I have to do that. And I really didn't. And I ended up pushing him out. And all of a sudden, my camera started picking up this deer in an area on the farm that I had never seen this deer before. And instantly, I just, you know, I regretted it. And I said, what am I doing? You know, because when I go in and I tell people, even in my seminars and stuff, when I'm doing land management work and setting land up, I tell guys, you have to give them that safety zone. You have to give them, you know, a sanctuary area, because it's too often that you go in there and all of a sudden you pressure this deer. It's, well, I guess to kind of go back, you, as I say in my seminars, I tell guys all the time, here's the thing. You go in there too often, you're going to be that guy that says, oh my God, my neighbor just shot the biggest deer of my life and he had never seen him before. You know, why is that? Because you panicked. You started going after that deer and putting way too much pressure on him and pushed him to a safe zone, pushed him somewhere that, you know, you, when you pushed him to that zone or out of your zone to the neighbor, now the neighbor shoots that deer because he's not in there. they're not in there putting that pressure. So you've given them that safe zone. Mm-hmm. And I learned that a long time ago, and I just didn't listen to myself and, you know, made that fatal mistake. Thankfully, it all worked out later on in the year, because then I listened to myself and said, you already did this. You pushed him out. Now, what do you have to do? So that's what I did. I just backed completely out and said, you know what? This first 2 weeks of season that I should be in there, I'm out, and I'm just not going to hunt him. He eventually came back to the same pattern. Thankfully, he didn't get shot by one of the neighbors, and he made his way back, and I ended up shooting him late October. But again, it's, you know, don't make that mistake. Just let your cameras tell you what they need to tell you year after year. I keep logs of everything and say, okay, this deer disappears on these dates. I've got a deer this year that I'm trying to tell myself, hey, don't go in there again, because these are the dates. If I look back on all my cameras for the last 5 years for the deer that I'm trying to hunt this year, it's telling me that if he doesn't get shot within the first 5 days of season, that he will be back in that area.
Right. It's very cyclical.
So, yeah. Right. So I'm thinking to myself, don't go in there and pressure that deer. And that's another big mistake I used to make a lot, was I'd go in and I'd pressure those deer too soon because the winds wouldn't be right or something, but I knew there was a big deer in there. And I said, I'm going to go hunt him anyway. And I would mess up that deer. And it's similar to what I did with this deer. You know, I knew better. And so I was changing things on wrong winds. I was in there messing around where I shouldn't have been messing around, and I pushed him out. Yeah. You know, thankfully in the end it worked out, but early season is a very, very tough time to be doing things, because they're not dumb. They're not going to forget and go, oh, well, now a hot doe just coming through here tonight, so I'm going to run right back through there. Mm-hmm. No, they're going to get smart and go, huh, I'm going to move, you know, maybe one or two hills over. Well, when you're in Wisconsin, you know, down where I'm at, you might only own 40 acres or be able to hunt 40 acres or, you know, have 100 acres. It doesn't take long for that deer to move a 40 acre parcel and somebody else sitting there waiting for you to mess up.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. I've had a lot of similar experiences, and it's not so much what I did, since I hunt mostly public land, but I used to do a lot of the, you know, I did a lot of the trail cam game, so to speak, here early on. I would run cameras all over the place. And, you know, we were allowed to run mineral licks and whatnot. And I would set up tree stands and get all these things going. But it was always on public land. And, you know, leading up to the season, June, July, so our season, our early season's August, I'd be just hundreds and hundreds, thousands even, of pictures, you know, daytime bucks and all kinds of great, great shots. And, you know, I'm sitting there counting the tines in the back of my truck before I even get them, because, you know, I got them so dialed in. Right. And then, you know, the holiday weekend comes or something comes, like, and then there's all these people in the woods, all these campers, not necessarily hunters, just lots of human pressure, you know, recreationalists. And then the pattern would just change. And you were like, well, you know, what the freak, what's going on here? Season hasn't even opened up, whatever. It's like the week before season and everything's changed. Or I would notice too, like opening, I came to realize that if I didn't get a buck killed on opening day, which is always, not usually, is always a Friday, and then everybody, all the weekend warriors show up on Saturday, Friday night, and then everything would change, you know, then the hunting pressure and everything would change. These deer, they're not stupid. They get it. They know, they sense. But I'm going to play devil's advocate on what you and I just discussed. I found, if you're one of those guys that feel like you need to go into your hunting area, then you got to be very systematic about it. And I mean this in a way that the deer is going to pattern you. He knows, just like when you're hunting somewhere where there's a farmer or a rancher, the deer, the elk, whatever, they get used to that rancher's truck. They get used, they don't go running when they see the truck, or they don't go, you know, they're not going to stay in there and watch you, but if they see you, they're just going to kind of bound off and whatever, and wait for you to go by and come back to what they were doing after effect. If you're going to do that, you got to do it like often. You got to be like become part of their routine, and you got to start that really early on. So, hey, I smell Art. The first time he's going to come undone, right? The second time he might come undone, third time, but it starts getting less and less, like it's like titration, you know, getting rid of an allergy, you know, and eventually, I smelled Art in here 100 times and Art's never done anything to me. I'm okay with Art smell. I actually had an old man tell me that he would go in and he would take one of his t-shirts off and put it in the tree stand. He would hang his sets, you know, right after the season, whatever, or keep them up year round. And when he would run cameras, every time once a week, he'd go in there and change every few days, he'd go in there and change the t-shirt and hang the t-shirt that he had worn already. And basically, it was like Pavlov's dog, you know, he's acclimating the deer to him so that when he was hunting it, if they caught a whiff of him or whatever, they were like, that's just Jim Bob. I'm okay. And little did they know.
I agree 100%.
Yeah. So I agree with you 100%. If you're not going to be that guy, you know, you're not going to put that much time into acclimating your deer, or if you don't have that kind of time, or you don't have a property that you can, you know, if you're hunting public land or whatever, you don't have control. But if you got your own tract, you know, you're hunting your own place and this and that, you know, you can do that. You can get the deer acclimated to you in you know, to a certain extent, where they're not going to come unglued if they catch a whiff of you, you know, they cross your trail that you use to get in the stand or whatever, you know what I'm saying? Like that kind of stuff. But you got to be real systematic.
The systematic thing, and to kind of add with you, even like for myself when I'm hunting, it's different. But now if I went out there today with season starting in 2 weeks and I took my tractor or my ATV mm-hmm. and checked my cameras, because they're used to my tractor. If I'm doing, you know, some type of field work on there or digging or whatever, it doesn't bother them. Or if I'm on my four-wheeler or my Ranger driving through, mm-hmm. and they'll lay there and watch me drive by, you know, and won't do anything if I'm checking trail cameras, if I'm, you know, doing things like that. However, if I'm on foot, mm-hmm. now that's a whole different thing, because I have them over, you know, the 20 some years we've owned this, is driving by on an ATV or on the tractor doing that stuff. They associate that with some type of work out there that I'm doing work.
Yeah, whatever it is that they're associated, it's not associating right. you as a threat. Yeah,
exactly. Right, and I don't know if they associate me with work. I mean, they.
I know what you mean.
I wish somebody would. No. But you know,
that's not what Michelle said.
Yeah, I know. No kidding. So, but yeah, it's I agree with that. That's kind of, I think they get used to certain things and adapt to those things. And so if you want to make that time, if I lived out there and I could do that every day, walk to my tree stands or walk to wherever, drive a Ranger up there and then walk, mm-hmm. I think they'd get used to that and get used to you, just like you said, and associate that, oh, that hasn't hurt me yet, so no big deal. Where, unfortunately, because, you know, 20 minutes from, you know, our hunting property, I can't do that. Yeah, I can't go out there and spend
feasible, yeah.
all right. It just doesn't make sense, you know? So yeah, right now it's being systematic the other way. And, unfortunately,
one or the other.
Yeah. And unfortunately, when you do it the way that, you know, we do it, is, man, you live and learn real quick that you shouldn't, that they don't, associate that. They still associate you with danger, and you're going to screw it up if you're in there too soon.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy because we made that realization. We have some private ground here that we run hunters on water holes and whatnot. And it's actually adjacent to a bunch of public land too that we do. And my guys were running cameras out there. One of my guides actually specifically was running cameras out there all year round. And he's constantly going out there and checking and checking and checking. And it's crazy because the deer got used to him, just like they're used to the ranchers out there. And like, you'll see when he like pulls up to a water hole, you know, if there's deer on it, they'll go scatter and they'll run. And then as soon as he leaves, they come back, you know, and that's public land, which is like, typically, and we're talking about coos deer in this particular instance and mule deer. But, normally, I mean, if you spook a deer here in Arizona, that deer ain't coming back. Not that day anyway, you know? So it was kind of cool to see that. Sort of on the same topic, we made a realization, my hunting partner, Charles, and I were sitting there, and this is the second or third time we noticed it, and that's kind of how we put the pattern together. We're sitting there in California, and we're glassing for blacktail, and you know, every once in a while, we look across the highway at the neighbor's place and looking at their place just because we're not seeing anything or whatever, just to see deer. And we're glassing them. We glassed up a few bucks, and a vehicle would come in. And this property across the street doesn't have any traffic, doesn't have any hunters at all. They don't hunt it. And in fact, most of the human interaction is down low at the bottom, right where you come into the property. So way up on the hills and stuff, the deer don't ever run into humans or anything. A vehicle pulled in, and we witnessed this three different times, pulled in and started driving up the roads. And it was like a rattly older truck or whatever. And the truck wasn't even close to where these bucks were yet. I mean, obviously they were close enough to hear it, but they weren't in eyesight of it. And they ran like if somebody shot at them. And they ran away. And first the realization was like, think about how many times you're driving down the road and you don't see deer, but how many deer could have been there and just heard you coming and took off, right? And the other realization is like, we drive around on our side and we see deer on the side of the road all the time. And it's like, is it because they're used to us driving around here? You know? And they don't drive around there very often, or, you know, like, and you start kind of like try to put these things together, but it was kind of eye opening. It was to me, I was like, wow, man, how many deer am I not seeing from the road that I maybe could be seeing? And the other thing was, are the deer here just that used to it? Like, did they get acclimated to the people on the road? Like, you know, you'll see it a lot where an animal will, if he sees, actually, this is a good example. Back east, especially in Long Island, when you're in your backyard, somebody's tracks that I hunt, it's right up against people's backyards, basically. And they're in the backyard, they're talking loud, doing whatever they do, and there's deer just walking around underneath your tree stand, nothing at all. But if you are in the woods and you made that much noise, they would come undone and run. So like, they're used to seeing people and hearing people where they expect to see and hear people. Just like you were saying, you know, on your tractor or whatever. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. And I think they get used to cars, what sound a car makes. Mm-hmm. I think if that same vehicle's there, oh, I know that exhaust, or I know that rattle, or I know. Mm-hmm. And if all of a sudden something new comes through, because I've seen that, you know, when I've switched vehicles, is we had a deer that we actually named Susie that lived out at our land. And, you know, she was definitely off limits. Nobody could shoot this doe. And she would lay in the yard of the cabin. She would lay across from it. She would, if I pulled up in my truck, she would be sitting there in high alert. She'd see it was my truck. She'd just lay down. You know, I'd talk to her. Hey, you know, call her. It didn't matter. you know, she would walk by my tree stand and she would look at me, and I'd walk in, she would smell where I walked, or she would almost literally follow me up. And she would sit there and stare at me, and then away she'd go, like no big deal. If soon as I got a different vehicle and pulled in, she would take off and she'd run 100 to 200 yards up on top of the hill, and I could see her up there staring back down at me. And then I'd have to start talking before she'd be calm enough to come back down. You know, so I'd have people pull up and she would just take off.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, well, and it would take her a while to get used to as long as I was there. But so I think that, you know, they get used to certain things, but they also associate, you know, the same thing with danger if it doesn't make the same sound, or if it's not, you know, the same shape, yeah, or something
familiar
to them that's different. Right. So it's, yeah. And it all comes back to, you know, where this whole thing started is it's either one way or the other, you know, and that's, there's really not much of an in between there to make it work. So it's either you do it this way and stay out, or you go in there every day and make your ruckus, do your thing, and let them get used to it.
Exactly.
I don't think there's I don't think there's a happy medium. I mean, no. I could be wrong, but I don't believe there is. It's one or the other.
For sure. Yeah. It's either be as, you know, low impact as possible, or get them a used to you, you know, in some way or another.
Right.
So, yeah, if you got another story to share with us, that would be great.
Oh yeah. I mean, we could go on for days, you know, if there's you know, kind of, you know, not necessarily a story. I'll get into one here, in a second, but, another thing that I've noticed, you know, as we were talking about trail cameras earlier, is, you know, and familiarities, is usually when you buy a brand new trail camera, they stink. And, you know, I heard for years that, oh man, if you know, that they're afraid of the flash, or they're afraid of this, or they're afraid. And I'm like, you know what, if they were afraid of the flash, man, when there was a thunderstorm, you better, you know, board up your windows and everything else, because they're going to be running, going crazy. I think, again, you know, as part of that first conversations with the association, is what happens is, you know, most of your, not most, but there's a lot of your first trail camera pictures are a deer, you know, standing there, and then the next couple pictures of her nose right up against your camera, and then gone. Mm-hmm. Well, I think what happens is because that smell is there, and you don't wipe that camera down, or you don't leave it out for days prior to taking it to the woods, it has that smell. They walk up to that and it either flashes in their face or it clicks. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the lesser expensive cameras, they click when they take the picture. That deer all of a sudden associates that with danger and says, yeah, this isn't good. People don't get pictures of those deer again for a while, especially mature bucks go, man, that deer just, he's gone. Mm-hmm. Years ago, I studied that and I put up cameras, and I had a really good buck, and he did that, and he disappeared. And I thought, well, what the heck? But 200 yards up the valley on my food plot, that deer was walking out in the food plot, the same trail that I had got him down here towards the bedding area. I was like, what is going on here? So I actually went out, and I found a secondary trail, a little trail, and I thought, maybe he's taking that. So I went, and I actually sat my tree stand just to see what was going on. And I watched that deer come out, and he was too far away now because I hadn't changed my tree stand in, because I figured hopefully he'd come through, or I'd be able to hunt him up farther. So I'm watching, and he comes out, and he gets about 15, 20 yards from that camera. He stares at it on the tree. It's still there. Mm-hmm. He backs up a couple steps, hits the other trail, and swings 20 yards around it, then reconnects with the same trail and walks up out to that food plot. And
doesn't surprise me at all.
So to me, it was like, okay, that was a big light that went off. And I said, okay, you know, if you put this in to, and you don't start overthinking things, you go, okay, it's the smell, something. So that attracted him to it. Human scent, either a flash, the click, something scared him. So that now he sees that on there. Well, then the realization kicked into me saying, you know, it's no different to me. If I walked in my front door and somebody put something on my kitchen table that wasn't there when I left, mm-hmm. I'm going to notice that.
Right.
First thing I'm going to do is I'm going to be like, okay, is somebody leave something in my house that is a bomb or shouldn't be here? You know, as you're looking at that, that's, you know, is okay. Who was in here and what's going on if you haven't, you know, talked to somebody. So then, you know, it's the same thing with that animal. They're looking at that on a tree going, you know, what is that? As I'm looking at this very tentatively going, okay, I'm going to walk up to this and check it. Well, if I walk up to that thing and I grab hold of it and, you know, the thing starts shaking and freaking out on me, well, I'm not going to go buy it again either. You know, so it was like putting two and two together saying, all right, the thing is still on the tree. He didn't like it when it went off in his face or clicked, so he's not going to walk by it anymore, but he still wants to get to that food plot because that's his source of food.
Right.
So how is he getting there? He's just changing how he's getting there. And that was a big lesson. And okay, I really need to take care of scents and scent on my cameras. If I'm just putting them out, you know, a week or 2 weeks before season, take care of that, especially on mature bucks. I mean, I'm talking more mature bucks. I, you know, and if you disagree with me, let me know. But I think, you know, 1 and a 2 year old deer, you can make some mistakes with them. And it's not going to be as big a factor. You start getting into 3, definitely 4, 5, 6 year old buck, they kind of know what's going on. They know the gig, and mm-hmm. you mess up with them, you might be able to get away with it once or twice, but especially in the early season, you might get away with it once. But after that, it's pretty tough. Now, late season or when you get into the rut, yeah, now you can have all kinds of, you know, you can mess up more than once because they got other things on their mind than worrying about staying alive.
Right.
So, but,
damn women.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like I said, other stories that you can mess up on, you know, I'll kind of, you want me to talk about another early season or.
Yeah. Take us through a hunt where you figured out something, you know, we can change. Let's change the topic here. We don't have to stay with you know, impact or education and whatnot.
But we don't have to do the early season. So
sure, whatever you want to do.
You know, one of the big things that I learned, and this was years ago. I learned this on a hunt, and it got me really thinking about deer calling and how to truly talk to deer, if you want to say, and most of it all comes down to timing. When your timing is, you know, ruts are different throughout the country, different deer, different, you know, areas. But here in the Midwest, I talked to so many people and they're like, you know, that first week in November 6th, 7th, I'm going to take off the next 10 days. And then you hear them, well, if I go out and, you know, I try rattling or I try this or I try that and it just doesn't work. Well, I learned that lesson a long time ago. And, I had one good buck that I was trying to kill back then, which back, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you know, mid 140s, 150, 150 inch deer was a good deer. Still is a good deer. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But, you know, where I hunt here, some of the other places, we've managed it for so long. They're still good deer, but back then it was like a giant. I mean, those deer was, and that was the deer I wanted to kill. And people are all, you know, have you tried calling this deer in this net? Well, you know, I knew some about deer vocalization, just enough to be dangerous, right?
Mm-hmm.
And more dangerous to myself than anybody else. Anything else, as I found out. So I got out there and I'm in my tree and sure enough, this buck shows up and he's coming across the field and I grab the horns and he won't do anything. I grab the grunt call. He won't do anything. Now I'm throwing everything but the kitchen sink at this deer that I know. And I come back in and I'm talking to one of the local guys and I'm telling him, you know, that I saw the deer and what happened. And he says, well, you know, what'd you do? And I said, well, I grunted at him. And he said, well, what kind of grunt? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, did you challenge grunt him? Did you, you know, snort wheeze at him? Did you? I said, well, I don't know. I just kind of went, brap. And he's like, oh, you're just doing social grunt. That's not going to do you any good. And I said, okay. And so three nights later, I see the same deer again. So I go out and I do this challenge grunt and this buck stops. I'm like, okay. And pretty soon this buck starts coming towards me. And so I'm thinking, all right, you know, I'm going to try this, you know, snort wheeze thing. Well, I do. And this deer just starts coming on a rope. Well, the thing that I didn't know is one of the worst things to do until that deer is in position, because a mature deer will go inside out on a snort wheeze, especially if he's one of the mature bucks in that area. But they try to get on your downwind side all the time right. To make sure. Well, this deer was right on that line. So instead of waiting and saying, okay, I'm going to wait till he gets up to this point, then snort wheeze at him. That will bring him down to me, you know, on the upwind side of me, and I'll still be to my favor. Life will be good, right? Mm-hmm. So I finally figure out this calling thing. I snort wheeze this buck. At the time, you know, buck of a lifetime to me, this buck turns. Here he comes. I'm getting ready. I'm thinking, okay, this game is over. And he stops. So I do a real, you know, quiet snort wheeze again. And he turns and goes right straight downwind to me. Mm-hmm. Game over. After that, I saw that deer two more times and I tried snort wheeze. I tried everything, but he had that figured out real quick. And what the game was, because I was in the same tree a few nights later when it happened again and he wanted nothing to do with it. So I ended up never killing that deer. I actually, after that third encounter, I never saw that deer again. Mm-hmm. I think I educated him way too much. And, you know, the lesson learned there was, first, know your calls. Know when it's too late or when it's too early. You know, don't be snort wheezing the first week of September when if they're still involved. I mean, it could work, but more than likely, you know, it's not as effective. And, you know, so figure out when to rattle. If you're rattling too late, if you're doing social grunts, things like that, you know, that time of year in that first week of November, end of October, the rattling works, the social grunts, now they're in the mood. They want a challenge grunt, or they want the snort wheezes, things like that. But the big lesson learned is learn your calls first, mm-hmm. but then know how to use them and when to use them. Because I went out and I figured them out. I used it, but I used it completely wrong. It worked, and it worked just like it should have, but it ended up messing me up for the rest of the year because I didn't know how effective a snort wheeze was on a mature deer. And I also didn't understand at the time. I understood, but I didn't really comprehend it, that they're going to go to the downwind side of me. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what he did. And he busted me before I could get that shot. Game over. Ended up educating him way too much and ran him completely out of my area. Never saw that deer again that year. Well, you know, after that next 3 days, I never saw him again.
So what I got from that one is that you called a second time. And if he was already coming, why would you call a second time?
Right. I mean, there was no reason to, just because again,
pinpoint where they're going to pinpoint where you're at and then, you know, yep. You could ruin it. But so, and now in hindsight, obviously this is all hindsight, but so he was walking down a trail and I don't, you know, obviously we can't see the direction and we don't understand your placement of the stand and all that. Right. You're saying that in this particular scenario, if you would have waited till he got a little bit further, that when he would have turned to come to you, he wouldn't have been able to get to your downwind side without passing you.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So there's kind of, to set it up, there's like a little valley right there. And he had to, if he would have crossed that valley, which was 80 yards, 90 yards out. Okay. It's just a little dip, not really a valley. It's just a little dip there. He was on the other side on the knoll, and there's woods behind me, and there's kind of an open little field through that goes to a funnel. And he was kind of heading out on the edge of that field, going to that funnel, cross that, you know, just before he crossed that, I got nervous that he would turn and go the other way as soon as he crossed that valley and follow the other wood line instead of my wood line. Mm-hmm. I thought, okay, well, I'll make him come this way. So before he hit that valley is when I snort wheezed. So instead of crossing, coming up across, he turned and followed that valley down behind me to come up, right, you know, from my downwind side right up over. And so if I would have waited for him to cross and made that, there's no way he could have got down in that valley without coming, because there's too much deadfall. He would have had to come within shooting range, mm-hmm, before he could cross down behind me. Yeah. And
so obviously this is not something you can teach, because it's all situational. It's about reading the topography, reading the situation, and then knowing. So I deal a lot with this, where, you know, elk hunting is, it's all about that. You know, it's all about,
right,
the setup of the spot. It's not necessarily how well you can make the sounds, as it is being able to read the situation and guide the, in this,
right,
you know, guide the elk or the buck into, in your direction.
No, it's just like you're saying. I mean, 100% situational, and 100%, you know, as I said, you got to know your calls, but you have to learn when to use them. But then you just threw in the mix, which is one of the biggest mixes, is knowing the land, knowing the topography, to know when to have to make that call.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, there's a lot of,
yeah, I guess the only
there's a domino effect there.
The teaching point is there, because that's just us talking. Like, you know, everybody who hasn't been in this situation doesn't really understand it. I guess the teaching point is there is visualizing the wind and how an animal would use your specific topography of the location that you're in to his advantage. You got to put your, when I do my elk seminars and I do my coyote calling seminars, because there's actually a good, those of us, you know, those of you listen to a podcast regularly, you've heard me talk about this. I did on my YouTube channel, there is a seminar that I did with West Coast Archery last year. It was geared towards elk hunting, but I talk about the commonality that links all calling. That's turkey, predator, deer, elk, you name it. There's a commonality, and one of those things is hang up spot that we talk about. And an animal is going to come to us. He's going to come a certain distance, and then he's going to get to a certain spot where he, she feels that she should be able to see, or he or she should be able to see what is calling to them or what is making the sound. Right. That's one commonality. Yep. The other commonality is how animals use the topography, how they, you know, look, identify the funnels, identify the, you know, direction, altering characteristics of what you're dealing with, of the locale that you're hunting or calling from, you know. And it's a hard thing to do, but you almost got to put yourself in the deer shoes or in the elk shoes. You go, all right, if I was this, what would I do? How would I be approaching this scenario if I heard this noise and I was on, you know, I was going in with a skeptical mindset, you know, or being cautious, whatever. How would I come into this? What would I, where would I go? How would I do it to make it so that I had the upper hand in this situation? You know, how would I look into this room? But
yeah,
that's a tough thing to teach. I don't know how you teach that. I'm still, I've been doing it for years and years. I'm going to use the term mastered loosely, but I mastered it with predator calling. And then I started applying it to everything else. And once I started applying those same principles, you know, I call in deer, I call in elk, I call in turkey, I call, you know, whatever, bear, coyotes, foxes, you know, all types of predators, everything with the same principles. Not the same way, but with the same principles, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, I agree with that, you know, and how to teach it is so hard, even in my seminars, especially without visual, to teach it, you know, looking at topo maps and looking at things. But, you know, I think with the information that you had just given and the story of, you know, how it unfolded or what happened, I think there's a lot of people that can relate to, yeah, I did this and the deer got downwind, or I messed this up, or I did. I think, like you said, is you have to get in that tree stand and actually visualize that and say, okay, you know, take what we've been talking about and say, all right, when that deer gets to this point, I guess that's when I try to call. And all you can do is try.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and if you mess up, don't give up. You know, don't say, oh, well, I messed up, I'm giving up, I'm done. You just, you have to continually do that. And I keep a log of how I messed up and what I did, because that's how you learn and make yourself better. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, listening to, you know, your explanation too, is saying, okay, learn how to call first. And whether it's, you know, you listen to audio tapes or you Google, what do I, you know, how do I snort wheeze? How do I rattle? How do I do all these different things, deer vocalizations? You learn those first, and then you learn, you know, I've done seminars on my YouTube page on deer vocalizations and when to call and when they're the most effective in our area, you know, in the Midwest. But then you have to be able to take that and get into what you said, is which is one of the most crucial. If you learn how to call and that stuff, that's great. But one of the biggest steps is putting yourself in trying to visualize yourself as that animal. And what am I going to do in this situation? If the wind is this way, or from this tree stand, that's why I try to, you know, set up a couple different stands for different winds. Within the same area, you know, and trail cameras tell you a lot, but you really have to study topo maps and learn wind, learn how it travels through hills, you know, thermals when you get out west where you're at elk hunting and stuff. I mean, thermals are a big factor. Mm-hmm. Here in Southwest Wisconsin, they're a big factor. That's one big thing, you know, that you have to learn. So there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle. I had some of those pieces already figured out. I just didn't understand how those deer reacted was the puzzle that I was missing. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's, you know, what we're trying to get at, or I'm trying to get at, is, you know, try to picture that and figure out what that deer is going to do. Because if you figure everything else out, then you have to figure out what he or she is going to do. Mm-hmm. And if they don't do it, learn from it.
Right.
And don't get discouraged from it. Don't say I'm the worst. I got a friend here that took forever to kill a big deer. And all I would hear, you know, for 10 years was, I'm the worst hunter in the world. I haven't killed a big deer. I haven't done this. I haven't done. And you'd have to, every year you'd have to give him a pep talk. Hey, this is just keep trying, do this. You know, and then he'd be like, well, can you help me out with this stand? No, your stand is in the right place. You just have to start paying more attention to your wind. You have to pay more attention to this. Well, then, fortunately, or unfortunately for him, he ended up having knee surgery, which was fortunate, because then it kept him out most of the time where he couldn't go in there, because it was like one of the only deer stands he had. So he'd call me. He's like, what do you think? I'm like, you know, winds aren't this bad. Last year, he ended up going in there and he killed 176-inch deer.
Wow.
You know, best deer of his life. I mean, just an absolute giant. And so, you know, that kind of, again, to the whole Boltfoot stories we talked about, is, you know, either one or the other. And this was going in there too much before on wrong winds, everything else. And, but waiting until season had started before he'd do it. And so, you know, now it was trying to figure out what those deer did. Well, now, you know, this is what they're doing. Well, I know that's what they're doing by my cameras. Well, then why are you in there doing this stuff? Oh yeah, but I'm calling now. Well, why are you calling now when you know that, you know, that's not the right time to do it? Well, it's the only time I have to hunt. You know, so sometimes we try to make things happen when we shouldn't try to make things happen. You know, because we're educating and messing it up more than anything else. So, you know, back to everything else we've talked about today is, you know, learn the calling, learn the wind, that stuff, and then do it at the right time.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's the biggest thing.
One thing I was going to add, I thought about earlier when talking about whitetail hunting and specifically, you know, stand hunting or blind hunting, whatever, there's a lot of downtime. You're sitting up there. One of the greatest things, one of the things that I've been doing, you know, now those cell phones and stuff to keep your brain occupied a little bit more. But back in the day, I would just sit there and I would visualize. I would visualize a deer coming down this trail. I'd visualize a deer coming across there, doing this, doing that. And just constantly doing that, and you can start thinking about, okay, listen, if a deer comes from here, and I call, or if our gear comes from that and I do this, what is the possible route? And you can just kind of run these scenarios. And if he does this, or if he does this, when would I get up to shoot? When would I, you know, those are like really, I mean, for me, when I started really paying attention to that is when my kill rate went up a bunch. Yeah. You know, it's not going to do anything for your ability to see deer or whatever, but when you do see a deer, your chances of success go way to hell up, because you've already done it. You've already seen yourself do it. You've done it a million times in your head, you know? So, it's just, I think that's an integral part of, one, learning how to be a good caller, being successful in general, and, you know, it's just a good way to mentally prepare yourself for what's to come or what could possibly happen. So,
yeah. And, you know, I guess we talked about that. That kind of brings up one thing that I'm thinking about real quick too, is yes, there's so much downtime, and I'm not a big, we don't have a lot of cell reception anyway out where I'm at, but I don't want to be on the phone all the time, because how often, you know, you hear people, I was on my phone and the deer snuck in on me. Or, you know, they saw right at last light, you know, the light shining on my face, and they saw me as I tried to move it into my pocket. You know, so I try to, you know, stay off it. I'll check it once in a while, you know, to find out, you know, messages or whatever. But the one thing that technology has given us today is, the other thing is, one of the things that I do is, when I get to a spot, is I like to mark that on my maps. There's so many maps out there now, you know, Onyx, there's base maps, there's all these different things. I use Onyx. I'm not sure what you use.
Yes, Onyx is my go-to. I use them all, though.
And so, okay. And so when I'm sitting there and I'm looking at my Onyx map, I can take that, because it'll show me right where I'm at. I can, you know, plug that point in, and then look at that piece of property that I'm hunting, and not necessarily why I'm in the tree, but when I get back home, boy, that's huge. Now I can sit there and I can look at that and go, okay, this is, especially if it's one of the first properties or something that I'm scouting early season and last in that area, where are these deer coming from getting to these points? If I sit there and look at that map, now I can look at the topo part of it, everything else, say, okay, this is where that deer's probably bedding coming out here. So this is where I should be sitting. Or if this is where I'm sitting, I'm going to mess these deer up here. So maybe I should change. So that technology has changed that game for all of us sitting in a tree going, okay, where are these deer coming from? What are they doing? Where's the nearest food sources or water? Information like that. Now I can mark that. I can go home and study that whole map and figure that out for what winds are going to be best for me to sit there without really having to penetrate that area in woods during the season to go in there and mess it all up.
Oh yeah, for sure.
You know, so, well, you know, I just thought about that when you brought that other point up. So, but, yeah, so, you know, hopefully, you know, people don't make those same mistakes.
Yeah.
And cost them a good deer.
Or hopefully they do make those mistakes and they learn from it.
Well, yeah, you know? That too. So
anyway. Well, cool, man. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing us stories with us and talking whitetail. It is definitely, it was my first passion and still is a passion of mine to chase whitetail around. I mean, to me, elk hunting and whitetail hunting are my two favorite. And then it goes to, you know, mule deer and coos deer and, you know, and then it starts branching out from there. But they're my favorite because they're the most technical. They're more, even though there's a lot of physicality in elk hunting, tons of physicality in elk hunting, but it's a chess match. And they're, you know, just as much as it is a, you know, football game, you know? And I love figuring out all the nuances. I love matching the wits. I love the whole, like for elk hunting, it's all about like the calling and the learning the vocabulary and when and where and how. And that stuff to me is just super intriguing. And in, you know, whitetail hunting, there's the calling aspect too, but there's all the, okay, you know, figuring out how they're using the habitat and, you know, placing stands and, you know, reading the wind and just figuring out patterns, all that stuff. Where like typically now you could do that too with, you know, coos deer and mule deer and all that other, and blacktail, all other undulates, really you could do that too. But typically when I'm hunting those, it's more glassing. It's more like, you know, if I put in the time and I put in the effort, I'm going to create opportunities. And there's still, you know, there's still a technical side of it. There's a technical side of every type of hunting, you know, coming up with the right stalk and so on and so forth. But the two things that I love about elk hunting and whitetail hunting is that it's a thinking man's game also, you know, and I like it. It's like, especially that's why I like elk hunting the best. Cause it's both.
I'm right there with you. If I was out west, I'd probably do a lot more elk hunting. But you know, being here, it's mainly
yep.
You know, my whitetails and turkeys and bear. So, yep. Yeah.
So, all right. Well,
I appreciate you having me back on, and always look forward to talking to you and spending some time. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Appreciate it.
Absolutely, man. Tell her I said hello and. We'll definitely see you guys soon. Hopefully get you back out here. I'm going to come out to the Midwest soon. I keep putting it off. I don't know why, but I want to come out and
yeah, chase you let me know and, we'll make it work.
Sounds good.
All right, sir. Well, other than that, I just wish everybody, listening, have a great, safe and successful season.
Yeah, you as well.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to check out daysinthewild.com and be sure to give us a review on iTunes. Thank you, and we'll check you out on the next episode.